Welcome to Greenbelt Festival Recorded Talks. This talk features Jim Wallace, speaking at Greenbelt 2006. The topic is God's politics, why the right gets it wrong and the left doesn't get it.
When you speak about God's politics, you start by admitting there's a lot of confusion in our world about what God's politics might be. And so a part of our task, I think, the job I want to say that we should share together in this world is clearing up the confusion about what so many people think about this topic. But see, religion, admittedly, is often a very confusing subject. My son Luke, who we just put on an airplane this morning with joy to go back to start school tomorrow, he was here and loved Greenbelt. But, you know, he came up to Joy and I a few months ago and he said, "Mommy, Daddy, I'm worried about Max and Jonah. Those are two of his second grade pals on the Little League baseball team that I get to coach." He said, "I don't think they believe in God or Jesus. I think they're vegetarians." So I met some folks from Oregon here yesterday in the U.S. I said I took them to Oregon where you could meet some godly vegetarians. You know, but there is a lot of confusion. When I was a kid, you know, I know that the way evangelical Christians bond is they share their conversion story. So I thought I might start with that today. When I was a kid growing up in Detroit, I like to walk around a little bit. In Detroit, I was from one of those families where they worried if you were 6 years old, which I was, and hadn't been saved yet. And so when a fiery revival preacher came in one Sunday night, they made all the unsaved kids sit in the front row, which is always empty because in the front row, people are afraid the closer you are to a sermon, the more impact it may have on your life, you know. But I had to sit there because I was one of the unsaved kids. And so this guy pointed, it seemed like, right at me, and he said, like you sitting down here, he said, "If your mommy and daddy came," no, I'm sorry, he said, "If Jesus came back tonight, your mommy and daddy would be taken to heaven, and you would be left all by yourself." It got my attention. I realized as a six-year-old, I would have had a five-year-old sister to support. And so I asked my mother how to fix this thing, because she was good at fixing stuff. And she told me, not about the wrath of God, but the grace of God, love of God for a little six-year-old kid. And I said, cool, and signed up. I repented of the sin and degradation of my first 6 years, which is my case was substantial. And I signed up, and, you know, vacation Bible school and youth group and the rest. That was my first conversion. It wasn't very deep, but, you know, not bad for a six-year-old. But the second one is what really took my life in a different direction. I was now 14. I'm in Detroit, Michigan. I'm now listening to my city. I'm paying attention, reading newspapers, hearing the news, asking questions. I begin to ask, how come in Detroit we live the way we do in white Detroit and life is so different in black Detroit? How come we never have a black preacher? How come we've never been to a black church? How come you taught me this song, "Jesus loves the little children"? All the children of the world, red and yellow, black and white, they are precious in the sight, and all of the kids here are white kids. How come? They said I was too young to ask these kind of questions. When I got older, I'd understand. Or many said, we don't know why it's that way, but it's always been that way. One honest answer said, if you keep asking these questions, you're going to get into a lot of trouble. And that proved to be true. I went into the city and I met the black churches. The other evangelical churches in Detroit, they loved the same Jesus, they read the same Bible, they sang out of the same hymn book, and made it sound so much better than we did. And I came back with new answers, new friends, and more questions. And one day an elder in my church said this, and this was a pivotal moment in my life. He said to me, "Jim, Christianity has nothing to do with racism. That's political. Our faith is personal." I think that's the night that I left. In my head, in my heart, in a couple years I was away, physically gone. Found my home in the civil rights movement, student movements of my generation. Came back to faith later. That's a different story. But I didn't have words to go around that experience then. I do now. And here are the words. God is personal, but never private. God is personal, but never private. This is a God who wants relationship. This is a God who knows everything about every one of us on the grass, in the stands, and wants a relationship with us anyway. But why? To sign us up for God's purposes in the world. The privatizing of Christian faith was the greatest heresy of the 20th century evangelical church. Just me, me and the Lord. Damn the world, me and the Lord. Look at the prophets who speak about this God's politics. Who did they speak to? Kings, rulers, judges, employers, those with power and authority. Who'd they speak for? Widows, orphans, those left out and left behind. What'd they speak about? Land, labor, capital, justice, equity, fairness, the stuff of politics. So for a long time we privatized. Then some people in my country on the political right, political operatives, called in the TV preachers. They said, "We'll make you a deal. I can tell you when the meetings were, dates and times. Give us your database, your church membership list, your TV donor list, and we'll make you famous. We'll make you household words. We'll make people in Britain know about Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson. We're going to turn your religion into a political movement to win for one side." The subtitle of the book, "Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It," kind of says it all for me. The right gets it wrong when they try to narrow all of what they call the moral values down to one or two issues: abortion, gay marriage. It's easy, just two issues. It's all you have to worry about. They're making it simple for us. Just two issues God cares about. But when I find 2,000 verses in my Bible about poor people, I insist fighting poverty is a moral values issue too. And now a whole generation of young Christians are also saying caring for God's creation, they call it creation care, the environment, is a moral values issue too. And so is trafficking, and so is HIV/AIDS, and so are the consequences of a disastrous war. These are all gospel issues, and I insist these are the issues of God's politics. So we put the book out, and what happened almost from the first week is all these people began showing up, and I began to realize that a whole lot of people have felt left out of the conversation. They were evangelical Christians who felt like they didn't want to be represented by a handful of television preachers who didn't sound like the way they wanted to sound. Or Catholics who didn't think the only issue on which they can vote was abortion, no other issues, or mainline Protestants, or young Muslims were coming out, lots of them, saying, "We're in a battle like you for the heart and soul of our religion. We need some help, allies, friends." Young rabbis coming out saying, "I like what you say about Isaiah's domestic policy and Micah's foreign policy. Let's apply our biblical faith to the pressing issues of our time." A whole lot of young people came out who would say, I'm spiritual, but not religious. It's a whole new denomination in America. Spiritual, but not religious. You get Ben and Jerry's ice cream over here? Well, Ben Cohen started that. He says, I'm spiritual, but not religious. I said, Ben, if you give them all free ice cream, you could be their bishop, you know? So he's thinking about it. And even people who said, I'm secular. I've never been to church, but I care about politics with some moral values. And wherever I went, I said the two greatest hungers in our world right now are the hunger for spiritual integrity, for spirituality, for wholeness, and the hunger for social justice. And the connection between the two is the one the world is waiting for. So we went all over the country. And the crowds got bigger and bigger and younger and younger. And I would meet kids in airports. They'd say, I'm 16-year-old kids. They say, I just wanted to shake your hand. You're the only Christian I see in TV and don't want to throw up afterwards. That's high praise, you know, from a new generation. Mm-hmm. I'm convinced something is happening. Now, yesterday, somebody walked up to me here and said, you know, I used to feel so alone, thinking that faith connected to justice. I felt alone. Now I don't feel alone anymore. I did this show called The Jon Stewart Daily Show, which is coming over here now. It's kind of most people under 30 in the U.S. more get their news from The Jon Stewart Show. He's on Comedy Central than all three networks combined. And we did that show, and it's, you know, Jon's very secular, but he liked this stuff, and we had a good time, and he's funny. We had lots of fun. But afterwards, I got these emails, and they were by the thousands. Young people said, I didn't know you could be a Christian and care about poverty or the environment or the war in Iraq. How did that happen? How did Jesus become pro-rich, pro-war, and only pro-American? It sounds like he's been hijacked, stolen. And I want to tell you that a whole lot of people in America right now have decided they want to take back their faith. I was in San Antonio, Texas just a couple weeks ago speaking to a whole bunch of Lutheran teenagers, 25,000 of them in the Alamo Dome, which is our big sports stadium. They had 20,000 we had the week before. 45,000 14 to 18-year-olds wanting a kind of faith that would make a difference in their lives. The churches ask for the edges of our lives, and that's what they get. A whole generation is looking for an agenda worthy of their lives, their gifts, their energies, everything they've got to give. I walked onto this huge stage in this big sports stadium, and they had the biggest cross I'd ever seen. Of course, it's America. We got to have the biggest of everything, you know? It was the biggest cross, and I had to walk under it to get onto the stage. I said, you know, it was kind of moving to walk under that big gold cross. But what would it be like if we decided to live under the cross? That's what's missing in an affluent country and a comfortable church. What's missing is the cross, where Jesus took on the suffering and pain of the world and redeemed it and overcame it and conquered it right there. And what I'm finding across the country is a whole generation is taking that path to a new understanding of their faith. I was at Azusa Pacific University, an evangelical Christian school, a short time ago, and 3 years ago, they had 30 students out of 3,000 doing any kind of service in the community, anything. Now they've got 1,500. And it's turning the school upside down. Their theology and politics is just jumbling everything up. A new generation is going into the streets. And and the churches are paying attention, and the media is paying attention, and the politicians are even paying attention, because they know that finally they're going to be held accountable to a constituency who says, how you treat poor people is going to matter in how I vote. Whether you vote to try to resolve our conflicts in a different way or you resort to endless war is going to affect how we vote. And whether you care at all about this creation that God made, that's going to affect how we vote. So the politicians are paying attention. I said in the first session yesterday, I'll say it again, I'm not inviting, people often say you want people to get involved in politics and join politics. And, you know, if you feel called to run for office, you should do that. I've got students of mine right now this fall are running for Congress, and I hope some of them win. They'd be better than what we have now. But I don't want to invite you to join politics, but to change it, to move it, to transform it. And what changes politics are social movements that have spiritual foundations. Always has, always will. That's why I like Martin Luther King Jr. and Wilberforce and Wesley. We've got to now, in our time, create the kind of social movements that can change politics. Someone told me last night in the van that when they, it was a journalist, when they interview, you know, your top politicians over here, and they have a brandy and a cigar, they often admit that they don't really do much or get much done. It feels to them like rearranging chairs on the Titanic. Well, that's true too often, until pressure comes from outside, from movements that hold politics accountable to some higher purposes. Your Jubilee 2000 campaign did that. You changed the whole issue of debt in the UK, in the US, and around the world. A faith-based movement that changed global politics. We've done that before. We have, people of faith, sparked movements that gained civil rights, ended slavery, brought women's suffrage, brought child labor law reform. We've done it before, and I think we can do it again. I am basically a 19th century American evangelical born in the wrong century. Because back then, the evangelists were revivalists who were reformers. They were evangelists who fought to abolish slavery, and Charles Finney was the Billy Graham of that time, the 19th century, and he invented the altar call. What we know now as the altar call, Finney invented it. And you know why? Finney wanted to sign up his converts for the anti-slavery campaign. That's why we first had an altar call. We need now a new kind of altar call. Calling young people who want to give their lives to Christ to engage in those purposes in our history right now. And if we do that, I believe we are close enough to maybe find the critical mass of people to reach what Malcolm Gladwell calls the tipping point on fundamental issues like poverty, the environment, a different way to resolve our conflicts. Tomorrow we're going to have a whole session on a better way to fight terrorism. I don't believe George Bush's war on terrorism is going to make your children and my children more safe. It's going to make them more vulnerable. And the best way for nations like the U.S. and the U.K. To lead an effort to defeat terrorism is not to pursue endless war, but to lead the way to fight poverty, HIV, trafficking, and a safe environment in this world. That's the way to defeat terrorism. But I'm telling you, they won't do it unless we build the kind of social movements that make it happen. But perhaps the greatest enemy to all this is something that you know about in this country, and I do too in my country. It's the most perhaps fundamental choice we're going to make about politics or about involvement in public life. It's a choice, I would say. Well, first I'll say, when I was growing up, I was told the big choice was between faith, you know, belief, and secularism. That was the big choice, because there's this monster called secular humanism. It's prowling. It's going to eat your children, you know. And we got to have belief in their side. No, that's not the big choice. There's issues there. They're important, but that's not the big choice. The big choice, I think, is a choice between hope and cynicism. That's our big choice. And I find that many people, even who are campaigners sometimes, or activists, or protesters, they still succumb to a kind of cynicism. I kind of like the cynics, because they see the world realistically. They don't see it through rose-colored glasses. They see the world as it is. And cynics are generally against all the bad stuff. They really are. But then they get out there for a while trying to change things, and they get tired and lonely, and then they feel a bit vulnerable. So they kind of retreat, take some steps backwards to a place called cynicism, where you're still against all the bad stuff, but you don't really believe it could ever be changed. So cynicism becomes a buffer against commitment, a safe place to stand, to be politically correct. I have all the right views, but I don't think really will ever change any of this. So I'll surround myself with a bit more security than before and just be a bit more prudent. Hope, on the other hand, isn't a feeling, a personality trait, or a state of mind. Hope is a choice, a decision you make because of that thing we call faith. Hebrews says, now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. And my best paraphrase still is, hope means believing in spite of the evidence and then watching the evidence change. I was invited to a place to speak a couple years ago, different kind of venue than a great festival like this or a university or a church. It was Sing Sing Prison in upstate New York. And the inmates wrote and said, come speak to us. It sounded interesting, so I wrote back, said, sure, when do you want me to come? And this young brother, one of the prisoners, wrote back on behalf of his friends, and he said, well, he said, we're free most nights. He said, we're kind of a captive audience here. He's a real comedian, this kid. So we worked it out, and the authorities were very generous and gave us this room by ourselves, and I was alone with 80 guys for about 5 hours one night in the bowels of Sing Sing Prison. And one night, and in that night, one of them said to me something I'll never forget. He said, Jim, almost all of us here at Sing Sing, we come from like four or five neighborhoods. A whole prison from four or five neighborhoods in New York City. He said, it's like a train begins in my neighborhood. You get on that train when you're 9 or 10 years old, and the train ends up here at Sing Sing. An amazing metaphor, an image of a fast-moving urban train beginning in only certain zip codes, going to inevitable destinations like Sing Sing Prison. But this young man had a spiritual conversion. He was part of a New York theological seminary program giving Masters of Divinity degrees to people behind the walls. You become a preacher in the joint. And when you graduate, when your sentence is up. And he said, when I get out, I want to go back and stop that train. 2 years later, I'm back in New York City leading a town meeting. Guess who's up front? Back home, stopping the train. When you're in prison in my country, you're probably poor to start, and then you're at the very bottom in prison. When people on the bottom can find that kind of faith to stop urban trains, or as the Bible says, faith the size of a mustard seed, what can you move when you got faith that size? Mountains. He knows we got some mountains to move, and he thinks faith is what moves mountains. So I want to say to you today, Greenbelt, I believe most of you are against the bad stuff, care about the bad stuff, but maybe you're stuck in that trap of not believing that it could ever change. Trouble is, the world depends on us, people of faith, to be able to see things others can't see, but for the eyes of faith. You see, Desmond Tutu saw a free South Africa long before it was a reality. He saw it through the eyes of faith, and then he bet his life on what he saw. That's our job, to bet our lives on unseen realities, to look for what we think is going to happen and to begin to live that way right now. If we do that, I think we can be a tipping point, even on some of the biggest issues of our time. I don't think we should just stand back and be an alternative and let the world go straight to hell. I think we can and have before in history and can again be involved in a way that changes things. And when we do, the church historians call that revival. Revival only counts when it changes something about a society. Otherwise, it's wonderful spiritual renewal, but it isn't revival until it changes a society. As I move around the country and sometimes around the world, I sense, feel almost a palpable rising up of a new generation of young people of faith and older people who want to believe again that their faith can change, even the mountains, the big stuff. In a conversation with your chancellor, perhaps soon to be prime minister, Gordon Brown, he said to me something that I thought was very striking. He said, you know, for the first time, we have the resources, the technology, the information, the knowledge to end extreme poverty as we know it. What we don't have is the moral and the political will to do so. Looks across the table and says, that's your job in the churches. He's right. He's right. Dave Batstone, who's here, is doing a new book on trafficking. It's going to be coming out next year. It's going to be an amazing book about this issue that we're all focusing more and more on. And, you know, Dave's been on 5 continents in 3 months. And he says, clearly, you know, poverty is at the root of the trafficking. How many upper middle class kids are being trafficked? If we care about trafficking, talk about prevention, which means dealing with the systems and structures and mindset and habits of heart which allow this to go on. 30,000 kids died yesterday and will today and will tomorrow because of lack of clean drinking water and diseases my kids don't die of and none of their friends die of and no food. And that, as Bono says, is just stupid. Needless, unnecessary, stupid poverty. If our faith got applied to that, we could indeed, as I often say, change the wind. I want to just leave you with a little commission, then we'll have some time for questions. It's a little commission that I often give at the end of talks back home, and I want to share it with you. It comes from a young woman from my streets, my city, my neighborhoods, Washington, D.C. She was a young kid. She was so smart. She went to Yale and got a Ph.D. And when you're young and black and female and you got a Ph.D., you can write your ticket to wherever you want to go. But Lisa Sullivan came back to the streets, where the children of the streets had won her heart. She became the best street organizer I've ever known. She's rap and hip-hop, and she hugged and scolded and loved and confronted. She was in the nonprofit world, what we call a capacity builder. She built all our capacity. She was the future. She was a star. She was on my board. She was my friend. And one day I got a call. Lisa's big heart had a heart ailment nobody had known about, least of all Lisa. And within 3 weeks, not yet 40 years old, Lisa Sullivan was gone. Some of us held each other at her graveside and just wept because she really was the future. She was a rising star. But she leaves us a commission that has stayed with me ever since that I want to share with you. It's some words she gave to us during those days that we had her. They came when people would say things to Lisa like this. Lisa, the problem is too big. The drugs, the violence, the streets, the corruption, the apathy, it's too big. And we're too small. Our staff, our resources, our faith. And Lisa, we don't have any leaders anymore like Martin Luther King Jr. We don't have any leaders like that, Lisa. And she'd get mad, she'd get angry, she'd say, don't say ever the problem is too big and we're too small, and don't you ever say we don't have any leaders anymore. Don't you understand, she'd say to us, don't you understand, we are the ones that we have been waiting for. We are the ones that we have been waiting for. I want to tell you, in history, it's when ordinary people get grabbed by a God who says, I want a relationship with you and I want you to fulfill my purposes in the world. That's when history gets changed. So I want to encourage you today, not to just be against the bad stuff. I think you probably all are against all the bad stuff. But to drop whatever cynicism has got you fooled to think that people of faith can't again turn history upside down. We've done it before, and a new generation wants to do it again because, my friends, you are the ones that we have been waiting for. Thank you very much.
Questions? For about 20 minutes. Yeah. All right. Thanks very much indeed, Jim. We have about 20 minutes, and Jim's quite happy to take questions. So if you have anything that you would like to ask him, if you come up to the front of the stage, you can speak your question into the microphone. It will be recorded, and so will Jim's answer to you.
Don't be shy, and try, though, if you can, to ask questions. And we're all prone to sermons and Q&A times. But to give more people a chance. And if you want to ask them, why don't you come up and just kind of line up here a little bit so we can get as many in as possible. And under 30 is preference bias. But come up and let's have a little bit of conversation.
I want to ask for your comments on something which I do find is distressing me more than a little. In the early 20th century, large parts of Europe went down the road of a divide between an anti-clerical left and a religious right. In its worst-case scenario, that led to the Spanish Civil War, where you had literally a war between an anti-clerical left and a religious right. One side wanted to slit the throat of every priest they could lay their hatchets on. The other side was a military dictator. Thousands of people fled from Spain and spent the years in refugee camps in southern France. I now look across the Atlantic and see America being polarized between an anti-clerical left and a religious right. It seems to me in your country that the Democratic Party has embraced the agenda of the anti-clerical left. The Republicans have gone with the religious right. That was a road to ruin in Europe. Can America be steered away from that?
Yes. I think we need better choices, and I didn't say enough about the left here. Let me say something about that. In the U.S., when I say the left doesn't get it, the right gets it wrong, the left doesn't get it, the left forgets its own history. In the U.S., we have a wonderful history, a progressive religious history of every major social movement in my country, was driven and fueled in large part by faith, religion, the abolition struggle, civil rights, women's suffrage, child labor law reform. They've forgotten that, and how a civil rights movement was made possible by black churches. And now it's a kind of secular fundamentalism, too often on the left. It's a disdain for people of faith and spirituality, even for language of values. And some of the Democrats now are having a change of heart, in part because they're doing the math. They got beat in the last elections, and part of the reason was they couldn't speak to a whole lot of ordinary people who are religious people. So part of them are just doing the math, but some of them are having themselves a change of heart. Some of them are finding, recovering their own faith that they've been marginalized within their own party. And now is a whole new conversation. I would recommend to you the best talk by an American politician in decades was given at our own Sojourners Call Renewal Conference. The new black senator from Illinois named Barack Obama is going to be a rising star in the U.S. He spoke at our conference, and his talk was from a Democrat speaking against that kind of false polarization. That is not how faith should impact politics, but how, it's not whether, but how. And I would, Barack Obama's speech is on our website. Our website is sojo.net, S-O-J-O.net. You can get Obama's speech and also sign up for our weekly email newsletter, which puts out speeches like his every week. Those are the bad choices. I think we can do better, and I think there's a chance that we will. Yes, please.
Jim, I think a lot of people of faith in the UK feel very disappointed, almost defeated, and feel that the prospect of a social movement of the kinds that you've been describing is a long way off. Not cynical necessarily, but ground down, exhausted. You know, more than 1 million people marched in Hyde Park 3 years ago against the Iraq War. Most of the populations of the European countries that committed troops to the Iraq War, the vast majority of the populations were against the war. Their governments went against them. Last year, we got 1 million people or more to Glen Eagles, and we got less than half of the demands of the Make Poverty History movement. You know, nothing on trade justice, the bare minimum on debt relief, yes, a doubling of aid. The horrors of American and British foreign policy in the so-called war on terror, Guantanamo Bay, the secret prisons, the torture, you know, the rest of it. I see a disengagement of young people, actually, from politics in response to, you know, the constant disappointment of those in power, of our Christian leaders. And I wonder whether we've got the wrong template, the wrong blueprint, that we shouldn't be going cap in hand to Blair, Brown, Bush, on all these hopelessly compromised figures, that they will never deliver. I don't know. I'm fighting very hard against the kind of cynicism that you talk about, and I feel very, very spent in the struggle on a lot of these issues.
Lee, thank you. I think you probably express a lot of people's feelings. When the war in Iraq finally began, and I know many of you worked very hard against that war, as we did back home, that was not a failure of the peace movement. That was a failure of democracy. A failure of democracy, because democracy spoke against the war in Iraq in almost every country. And yet political leaders ignored the democratic impulses of their own people. Let me just remind you that most Christians around the world and most church leaders were against the war in Iraq. And so the political leaders, they disregarded their own democratic voices, and they basically refused to listen to the wisdom of the churches and went to war. And look what has happened It is not Christian to say, I told you so, but I will say that most of what has happened now in Iraq is predicted in statements by church leaders before the war began. But I want to caution us, particularly those of us who live in affluent countries, we are the kind of people who often are in need of immediate results. I remember once in Pretoria, a long time ago, I went out to from Johannesburg to Soweto long before Nelson Mandela was free, in the difficult years where democracy was beaten down again and again and again and again. And the consequences for them were far more severe than for most of us. And I met 14-year-olds in black townships, and I'd ask them a question. I'd say, will your children, ever breathe free air in South Africa? And 14-year-olds looked me in the eye and said, I will see to it. I will see to it. At that moment, most people in the world didn't think that a free South Africa was possible, at least not without major bloody confrontation. I'm not sure I did, to tell you the truth. I was there out of solidarity with friends, with Desmond Tutu. We were working out the sanctions campaign. I was there because of my commitments, but I'm not sure I would have said that I thought this was possible. But when I heard those kids look and tell me what they intended to do, I knew that it was only a matter of time before Pretoria would fall. And then being at the inauguration of Nelson Mandela, it was such a confirmation of the faith and hope of the people who believed against the odds. You know, we say the odds are against us. We keep losing battles. You know, there's so much more strength on their side than ours. That's why we call it faith. That's why we're called people of faith, because you don't demand immediate results. You build movements for the long haul. And some days you win, and some days you lose. But when you're in a movement, you know that people in other places are going through what you're going through. We don't know yet how to think movement. We think organizations, we think policy, we think politics. And I don't believe in going cap in hand to political leaders. I believe in going with movements that can't be denied. So Martin Luther King Jr., when he got the Nobel Peace Prize because of the civil rights law in 1964, he won the prize. He didn't even go back to Atlanta where he lived. He went back to Washington to speak to Lyndon Johnson, the president. He said, okay, now we have a civil rights law. We need a Voting Rights Act. We can't vote in the South. We need a Voting Rights Act now. Johnson says, I'm sorry, I've cashed in all my chits with the Southern senators. I've got no influence left. I can't get you a Voting Rights Act for 5 years, 10 years. I can't do it. I'd like to, but I can't do it. You know, Johnson was like a lot of our people. They'd like to do the right thing. They just can't quite do it. King said, we can't wait 5 or 10 years. We need voting rights now. Well, I'm sorry, says the master of realpolitik to the nation's moral leader. It's not politically possible. The king was not one to whine or complain or withdraw, but to organize. And he went to a sleepy town in Alabama nobody'd heard of called Selma. And in Selma, the people of Selma marched across the Edmund Pettus Bridge to face the shock troops of Sheriff Jim Clark with the clergy and a man named John Lewis, now a congressman, young kid then, was beaten almost to death on that Sunday, Bloody Sunday, they called it. And the nation's attention turned to Selma. And within 5 months, we had a Voting Rights Act. Not 5 years. 5 months. King had changed the wind. He changed what political reality was. And all of a sudden, it was possible now to pass the Voting Rights Act. I share your discouragement and pain, obvious pain, about those losses. But I see a movement growing up around the world that is going to dig in for the long haul and is not going to come hat in hand to politicians, but is going to say, we represent constituencies whose voice will be heard. William Wilberforce lost 33 times in the parliament before the slave trade was finally ended. 33 times. And 3 days after the final victory, he died because his work was done. It's not going to be easy, and that's why it's best a job for people of faith, because we're going to need all the faith that we can get.
So we're the ones that we're waiting for.
We're the ones we've been waiting for.
3,000 children die due to lack of drinking water and food.
30,000.
30,000. Mm-hmm. Every day?
Every day.
Every day.
Under five.
Under five. If it costs £1 per head per member of population of the world to provide fresh drinking water for those children who are dying every single day, why aren't we doing it?
You know, when you look, David Beckman runs an organization called Bread for the World back home, and he's a policy wonk from the World Bank, but a Lutheran pastor who now works full-time to end hunger. And, you know, he gets there on the stage. I love to do stuff with David. He gets there, and he's always wearing a nice suit and tie, and he looks like a World Bank guy. And he quotes like you did the statistics, and he says, we could very easily change this. It wouldn't take very much. It's not even that expensive. For all the things that they vote, you know, my country, they voted to build a bridge to nowhere in Alaska. And it costs more money than it would cost to intervene in Darfur and end genocide. But these things, it's a matter of what their priorities are, you see, and what our priorities are. And David sits there, he has the facts cold, and he says, it wouldn't take much for us to do this, so why don't we? It's the same thing as what Gordon Brown's saying. But see, that's the kind of question that movements pose. I think most people in my country, if the choices were made clearly and starkly, and they had a chance to respond, if there were referenda taken, with choices being clearly laid out, we would win on many of the big issues. But it's all obscured by complications and political realities and media noise. Media noise and not clarity of information. That's what movements can do. Clarify the issues, clarify our choices, and call for a new commitment. Couple more.
I'm at a big evangelical church in Brighton, and the elders are wary or probably even suspicious of any political movement because it sounds too much like we're telling people what they should think. And so for a very small minority of us in that church, it just feels a bit like there's nowhere to move with that. So I was just wondering what you'd say in terms of any encouragement for us.
Did you ever hear of a church called the Willow Creek Community Church? It's a big mega church in Chicago, in the U.S. Bill Hybels is the pastor there. It's one of our biggest churches, big evangelical church. And we had a visit last week here, 2 weeks ago, from the new Social Justice Committee of Willow Creek Community Church. And they're all about your age. And they've got this thing, there's about 12 of them, and they're going to make social justice a priority in Willow Creek. And they're committed to do so, and they were just there to pick up resources and encouragement. And you know, they had it all figured out. We didn't have to help them figure out anything at all. They just wanted some encouragement and some resources. There's so many people out there that I meet who need just that. Resources, and encouragement. And that's why I think there's something afoot. The Spirit is doing something that we haven't seen in the U.S. for a long time. But people need what you just said you need. They need to be encouraged and know they're not alone. And they need practical, concrete, specific resources to help them do what they do. So a lot of what we're doing now through the SojourNet website is we're trying to offer both encouragement and resources, and then times to gather together, to act together, to make a difference. We had a campaign, you might mention the whole money question, a campaign called Budgets Are Moral Documents. And we worked with Congress, members of Congress, for over a year. You know, we wrote them letters and visited and called them and did all the things you're supposed to do. And in the end, they're going to vote this budget, it's spending $5 billion a month on Iraq. $5 billion a month, but not $5 billion over 10 years for childcare. And cut food stamps and cut health care and education and all the rest. So finally, in the end, 115 Christian leaders came to the steps of the Congress, including a lot of evangelical, John Perkins, who's been here, was there. And we prayed and we sang. And when you pray and sing and read scripture on the Capitol steps, they arrest you and take you to jail. So we all got put in jail, and it flashed through about 100 newspapers across the country. And here were these Christians, and they were there fighting for health care and child care and education and fairness and justice, not just abortion and gay marriage. And it just confused everybody. It was a whole different voice than they'd seen before. And what happened out of that, I think, we didn't win. We lost by 2 votes. Dick Cheney, though, you know, the vice president, have you heard of him? He had to come back to cast the deciding vote to pass the Bush budget. I don't think he was hunting that day or something. He was free. You've heard about his hunting accidents. He came back. So we barely lost. We lost the vote. But what happened was that action encouraged a whole lot of people around the country who felt like they had a voice, they're part of a voice, and next time we're going to be even stronger. But encouragement maybe is the most important thing that movements need. How do you nurture and nourish and strengthen each other all the time? You know, talk to Shane Claiborne about building communities of people who are trying to live a whole different way of life. You can't do that without encouragement. So how do we take care of each other in this movement and make sure no one gets too tired and too discouraged? That's as important as the political goals that we lay out for ourselves. One more.
I guess you just hinted at it, but just, you know, after a long time with standing with your face in the wind all the time, or trying to, it does get really hard. And it's been really encouraging for me just to hear you. But what are, in your recommendations, the best antidotes to cynicism?
You know, let me just, in response, that's an important question. There's a choice that, particularly for younger people here, that I'd like to suggest as we close here. It's a choice. When I go to these Christian college campuses a lot, I suggest they shut down their career counseling departments, because there's a very big difference between career and vocation. And here's what I mean. Career is where you assemble your assets. You know, you put your resume together and you figure out what your strongest qualifications are so you can start and on some ladder of ascent at, you know, not even at the bottom rung, but as high as you can. So my Harvard students think they deserve to begin in rung 4 at least, being from Harvard, you know. And that's what career is, assembling your assets. Vocation is different. Vocation is discerning your gift. What's your gift? Well, what's down deep? What's that passion stuff, that heart stuff? What do you lose track of time when you're doing? What do you most love? What's probably who you most are? What will you probably put on this earth to do. That's your gift. Where your gift meets the crushing needs of the world, right there, that's your vocation. And so I want to see a whole generation of young people move away from the career track and discern what their vocation is. What's their gift, and how does that meet the crushing needs of the world? And if we can discern our vocations and then join a movement, there's tremendous support and nourishment for us in those choices. So we're not always just fighting up against the stream and against the wind. We feel like we're right in the place where God wants us to be. I'm right. I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. I'm where I belong. I'm doing what I should be doing with the people I should be doing with it with. And you know what? They're doing it everywhere else too, all over the place. And I just don't even know all the places, but I know what's going on now, and we're not alone anymore. And the powers that be have always been in serious trouble when people decide to live by a very different vision of what it means to be Christian, to be human, to be an American, to be a Brit. This is what I think is possible now, but only if we learn to think movement. I want to move us from ministry, which is a wonderful thing, taking care of folks, that's great stuff, to good models of how you do all that stuff, to movement. Ministry, to models, to movement. I think it's movement time, and a whole generation's telling me that, and I want to listen to what they're saying. And in movements, people take care of each other, they establish clear goals, and they don't go hat in hand. They go with social movements that have spiritual foundations, that have changed history, and I'm convinced we'll do it again. Because, as Lisa Sullivan says, after all, we're the ones that we've been waiting for. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to Greenbelt Festival Recorded Talks.